I have a joke about AI before we get into it, if you want to hear it.
Yep, let's hear.
Okay, so AI is like teenage sex. Everybody's talking about it. Everybody thinks they should be doing it. Everybody thinks everybody else is doing it. And so everybody pretends that they're doing it.
Know you wear a lot of hats, right? You're a cardiologist, you're a columnist, a podcaster, and for people who really don't know who you are and what you do you mind introducing yourself?
Sure. So my name is Christopher Labos. I am a cardiologist by training. That is my day job. But I do a lot of other things. I write a column for the Montreal Gazette. I have my own podcast called The Body of Evidence, where we sort of examine the body of evidence on specific questions. So we debunk a lot of stuff. We find out what's true, what's not, and we try to lace that with a little bit of humor. So I like to call it the only, at least the only medical comedy podcast that I'm aware of. So we try to take a lighthearted approach to all these things. I do a lot of work with the media, so I'm often on radio. I have a regular segment on CJD radio in Montreal. I do regular TV work with both CTV and CBC, so I have regular features with them as well. So I do a lot of talking to the media. And what else do I do? I wrote a book. The book is called Does Coffee Cause Cancer? So it's about debunking food myths. And the book itself is written as a romantic comedy. So you can read it as a romantic comedy, but then you're also going to learn about food and food science and food myths and epidemiology and all that stuff. And I write a regular column for Medscape. So for people who don't know what that website is, it's a medical information website written primarily by physicians. So it's a sort of notch above some of the other stuff that you're going to find on the internet. And then with them, I do a regular video series called On Second Thought, which is sort of looking back at evidence to find out why stuff that we used to believe is true is not. And so that's another video segment you can find on YouTube or on the Medscape website. So I do a bunch of different things, and I'm still teaching at McGill. I'm teaching two classes this semester. I still do research, sort of helping people. Now I've been doing a lot of projects on preeclampsia, but I've really just been assisting other people rather than driving my own research program. So yeah, I do a lot of different stuff. And, cardiology is still my sort of bread and butter because that's what pays the rent, as it were. But I've interested myself in a lot of the things that are related to medicine because I'm a curious person, but I also like debunking and explaining stuff to people because there's a lot of medical information out there and a lot of medical misinformation out there. And I think that is very confusing to people. So that's why I do all this other stuff, none of which makes me any money, but it's fun to do.
Amazing. I think that's it's incredible. Just gotta ask, how do you get from cardiologist running your own practice? I'm sure you've answered this question a million times, but you go from managing your practice to doing all this media stuff. What was that transition like? What happened there that you were like, you know what? I want to get into the media space and just provide information to the average listener. It's like you said, there's a lot of misinformation on the internet, right? And for people like us, non-medical, professionals, we go to the internet and we get information, and maybe you just agree or accept it for what it's worth, but you really don't know exactly what you're reading, So I'm just curious, how did you transition from running a practice to being in the media space?
Well, the media stuff actually started even before I'd finished my training. I was still doing my master's degree in epidemiology at the time. And I had seen this article about strawberries, and it was about how strawberries were supposed to be good for women's cardiovascular health. And they're not especially bad, but they're not especially good for you. Actually, strawberries have a lot of sugar in them. So if you're looking to cut sugar out of your diet, you got to be careful about a lot of these very, very sweet fruits. But anyways, I saw this article and they did something that is mathematically not quite ideal. Basically, what they did was they looked at something called the relative risk as opposed to the absolute risk. So they said something like, eating strawberries is going to reduce the risk of cardiovascular disease by 27%, let's say, in women. I forget the actual number. And that sounds impressive, but you always have to ask yourself when you're talking about a relative ratio, like what's the baseline risk? Because doubling a very small number is still a very small number. You could double the risk of something, but if the risk of that happening is very, very low, nothing changes. Like if the risk of something happening is 1 in a million and you double it, it becomes 2 in a million. Well, that's still a very small risk. So I wrote this article for the Montreal Gazette, essentially trying to explain what the risk is and what is the difference between relative and absolute risk. And I sort of said, look, you can, reduce the risk of cardiovascular disease by 27% if women eat strawberries. But if you look at it another way, it's mathematically equivalent to saying that you have to take 18,000 women and force feed them strawberries every day for 2 years to prevent one non-fatal heart attack. And when you put it that way, it's obviously a much, much less impressive finding. And so that was the first thing I did. I wrote this letter to the editor to the Montreal Gazette, and that eventually grew into a regular column. And then that grew into radio and television here in Montreal and then nationally. And then I started doing stuff with Medscape. And shortly after that's when I started the podcast with my friend Jonathan, who unfortunately isn't part of the podcast anymore. But I sort of started all these things because, if you don't do this, people will just read headlines that say that strawberries are a way to prevent heart disease in women, which, they're not. And so, and then all of this just became supercharged during the pandemic, where there was so much misinformation going on about COVID that a lot of what I did was very much about trying to sort of calm the public and explain things properly. And then because of all that, I wanted to write a book about science. And so it ended up becoming a book about food myths, which I thought was going to be easier for people to sort of deal with because, when you write something about COVID, it becomes so inflammatory and just people just get crazy about it. So it was sort of a journey that sort of happened over the course of the better part of a decade, and it sort of evolved very, very slowly.
Okay. Wow, amazing. I gotta say, I listened to a couple of episodes of your podcast, and to say the least, I was in stitches, because I didn't expect that. I didn't expect for a medical podcast to have some comedy in it. And so, the first few segments, just listening into it, every single segment just had some interesting tidbit intro into what you're going to talk about, whether it's about water or coffee or whatever it is. And yeah, so I found that it was very interesting. But when I think about it, how do you go about choosing the topic to talk about? On your, because there's, I know there's a million different myths that you can sit here and debunk, right? And you're a cardiologist, so I'm sure your interests are also limited, but what's your process there? Like, how do you pick these subjects to talk about?
It's a combination of factors. Sometimes it's what's in the news, what are people talking about. So when, people are talking about measles, we'll talk about measles. When people are talking about seed oils, we'll talk about seed oils. Some of it are evergreen topics, so things that people are curious about, but there's no particular temporal hook for it. So we'll do an episode on hormone replacement therapy because that was something a listener requested. The way that came out, actually, there was this study about a new medication that was being used that could be used to treat menopause, and it was a non-hormonal therapy for menopause. So we did a segment on it. It was kind of interesting. And then one of our listeners said, "Hey, can you do a thing about menopause? Because I've been seeing and reading all this contradictory stuff about HRT, hormone replacement therapy." And so that became an episode. And then that sort of Then the follow-up to that was, could you do something about polycystic ovarian syndrome? So we did an episode on that. And so some of it are viewer requested. Some of them are things that I find interesting. Some of them are topics that I think people will find interesting. And some of it is what's in the news. So we're essentially trying to build a repertoire. We don't want to, I try not to be, chasing headlines, because you want the stuff to be there so that even somebody who comes to the show late can listen back to an old episode and still understand it and still find value in it. So if you want to learn about rabies, well, we have an episode about rabies, and that it's still of value because, while the science obviously keeps changing, it doesn't tend to change that quickly. So, for several years after an episode comes out, I think the science is still going to be good. And it's a point of reference, I think, for people who want something that is a little bit more researched, a little bit more sort of skeptical, and in the sense is that we're not going to just accept things at face value. We're actually going to dig in to the evidence base and say, it's like, okay, well, this does work, but how much does it work by if it's only going to make a small difference and maybe it's not cost effective? So we try to give a more nuanced interpretation and analysis of what the scientific evidence actually says.
Okay, because I used to listen to this podcast. This neurologist based out in the States. It's been a while, maybe 3 to 4 years. the neuroscience podcast, right? Shared over 200, 300 episodes. And then I started listening to yours. And like I said before, I can see the difference, the humor, the comedic side of it, because I listen to a lot of stand-up, right? And that definitely keeps the interest. Is this something, are you on social media? Do you try to, like, not promote, but just have this information out there? Because what we all do is spend a lot of time on social media swiping, right? So if you're really trying to get this information out there, is that something you're thinking about doing? Just, putting it out on the social media? Because to be honest, that's where you get the most misinformation.
Yes, that's true. Social media is a challenging thing because it's not the most conducive platform for these more intricate scientific discussions. Social media is brief, right? It's short capsules. I mean, there's no sort of a character count on Twitter anymore, or X as it's called. But it's problematic because, first of all, this is very toxic. I mean, Twitter or X, especially in recent years, has become so toxic that a lot of people have just left it. And it's so political, it's so one-sided that I don't find it a worthwhile investment of my time. I mean, shockingly enough, you might sort of be surprised by this. I get far more engagement on Facebook. You might be, oh, Facebook, who's on Facebook anymore? But the reality is, older people still use Facebook. I mean, I still have a Facebook account. I use it to sort of connect with people so people can find me. But people are, and I think Facebook actually gives you a little bit more space to sort of like answer and talk to people. I mean, the problem with things like Instagram is it's a very visual medium, and a lot of what we do doesn't necessarily lend itself to this. If I was good at drawing and I wish I was a better animator, I would be making animations to put on Instagram to explain this stuff. I just don't have that skill. And so I don't have an easy way to use the visual medium that is Instagram. And I don't particularly want to use TikTok for, I'm gonna be very honest with you, I'm a little bit concerned about, my personal data. And so the US was about to ban TikTok and then they didn't. And here in Canada, there's been warnings from the federal government about it, about, where your personal data is going. So I don't really want to start using that particular platform. And so this is the issue. Like, social media is not one thing. There's many different platforms. And then you have to ask yourself, is like, okay, well, which platform, and what happens if that platform loses popularity or goes away? Like, if you had spent all your time building up your TikTok audience and then all of a sudden TikTok gets banned, then what do you have to show for it? So I understand what you're trying to say, and of course I try to do it, but there's a finite number of hours in the day. There's only so many things you can do, and so I don't spend as much time on social media as other people do. I produce the stuff that I do. Even broadcasting via traditional media, people say traditional media is dead. It's not. I mean, even with a local Montreal media outlet, which is what I do, it still reaches thousands of people, tens of thousands of people when you're doing the broadcast. And of course, this stuff gets broadcast across Canada. It goes online and it's there. The clips live forever. So there's still a lot of value to doing it. And so I understand why the argument now is being made, is like, we have to be on social media to push back against the misinformation. And that's true, but it's a very labor-intensive process. And for me to do this for fun in my free time, I don't know if that's the best investment of my time. What I do is, I produce the podcast, I put it out there. I think we have fairly good listenership to, we're not getting millions of listens and downloads, but we're getting tens of thousands of downloads. I mean, it's good, right? And I'm pretty happy for what is essentially an independent Montreal-based podcast. Like, there's not many of them who are able to get, thousands of downloads every month. So I think we're chugging along, we're doing good, and I'm doing my best. And if I can find the secret sauce to make it grow and be more effective, I'll certainly do that. And you do that by trying stuff. And I know what I can do. I know what I can't do. If there's anybody out there who wants to do low-level animation cartoons for free, we can start a social media venture and get that off the ground. So that's what I'm always looking for new opportunities. And nobody knows what's going to work. Nobody knows what's going to be successful. You sort of play your strengths and you sort of try and see.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree, because you don't want to take out the fun out of what you're doing, because you enjoy it, right? So if you want to invest way more time, at some point it might get, too overwhelming, and you don't want to get to that point, right? It's a hobby,
That's it. And if you don't like what you do, it's going to start becoming very, very challenging. And so because I don't inherently like social media, I just don't. It's not in me. I'm not somebody who enjoys being on Twitter and getting into Twitter fights. Okay, it's called X now. I'm going to keep calling it Twitter for the rest of my life.
I do too.
I don't enjoy it. And so that would start to become very tiresome for me. So I'd much rather spend my time doing things I enjoy because I can derive pleasure from it. And you know, and it's hard. I just finished recording a podcast episode before we started recording this interview. And so there's work to be done. I have to write up the show notes. I have to like do some basic stuff. So there is work to be had in doing it, but it's pleasurable work. Like it's not onerous. It's not something that makes me feel bad. It's something that I feel good about. And I feel good about saying, look, I have this podcast and people can go and check it out. And it's fun. And it also forces me to read up on stuff and to learn about stuff. So it keeps me fresh and up to date. This is sort of, it's why I love to teach because you're not just teaching the students, you're teaching yourself because it forces you to get better at the things you do and to not become complacent because that's the real challenge, that's the real danger, right? When you've made it in life, you'd be like, ah, I know what I'm doing just to be on autopilot. And that's always a very, very dangerous thing to do.
Yes, it's, I agree. I think that's a slippery slope. You get to that point and you don't have the drive anymore. It's not a good place to be. Well, some people enjoy that, right? Some people enjoy that, and it works for them, fine. But yeah, it's not a place that I hope to be. Because I see sometimes I go to Reddit for research. I don't know if in terms of part of your research process, if you ever look at Reddit, because there's so many different subreddits with so many different myths that you can spend hours and hours just being shocked by what has been spread out there. I don't know if you ever spend some time just like sifting through Reddit.
I don't like Reddit. I mean, I understand it. I do search it sometimes and it sort of comes up. I don't enjoy it the way some other people do. And because I don't enjoy it, I just don't do it, which means that maybe I don't have my finger on the pulse of what the young people are talking about. But I do occasionally want to see what's out there. And that's where, I mean, the advantage of having a team really helps. So I have a couple of students who are like, you know, very enthusiastic about science communication. They want to debunk stuff. They want to do something that's important. And so I'll ask them, is like, well, what are you seeing on your social media feeds? And that's where they will come up with stuff. So the episode we just recorded was about sleep maxing. It'll be coming out shortly. It may even be out by the time this interview is released. And it's not something that I would have heard of. But because you have people who are finding this stuff and then bringing it back to you, you'll be like, oh, this is kind of interesting. I've never heard of this before. Let me dig into it. Let me see what the science here actually says. Or, you know, you'll find out that there's this thing trending on TikTok where these influencers are, you know, telling young women that birth control is dangerous. And it's not. I mean, billions of women take the hormonal birth control pill. I mean, it's not dangerous. There are certain contraindications, there are certain side effects, right? Nothing is entirely benign. But this is the value of being in these spaces to see what people are talking about. But because I know that that's not something that I enjoy, I'm very happy to let other people do that. And that becomes their contribution to be like, hey, this is what's going on out there. This is something that we need to sort of clap back on.
Absolutely. No, it's I agree. I mean, I think for someone like you and what you do, I mean, you do so many different things, so it's tough to deep dive. I always find myself in a rabbit hole when I'm on Reddit because there's so much interesting subreddits out there, just even for example, when I want to do a poll, I did this poll a year ago about just when it comes to why there's a high churn rate in clinics in terms of administrative staff, right? That why do the secretaries, quit? And I had a list of options. I did the poll. I tested on LinkedIn and on Reddit, and I obviously got way more traction on Reddit, and it really gave me a good insight. You don't want to abuse the platform, but you want to be able to use it, and maybe something that can help me with my research process or the projects that I'm working on and so on. So I think there's really some value just depending on what you're interested in. But let's jump into your book, right? So you wrote a book,
Yes, it is
and
on the on it's on the bookshelf behind me. You see the yellow book back there? That's the book.
yes,
I would go and get it if it wasn't just slightly out of reach. I can't quite reach it. But
okay.
that's the book. It's called Does Coffee Cause Cancer? If you're worried that coffee causes cancer, you have to read the book to find out if it's dangerous or not. It isn't. But the book is it is a romantic comedy, and I sort of have to explain this to people, and they're always a little bit surprised. So the book
Yes.
is a narrative, like it is a story with a beginning, middle, and an end. The story is the story of this doctor. It's not autobiographical, but everyone thinks it is.
Was about to ask, but go
Yeah,
ahead.
they sort of hear my. So it's about this doctor who goes to a medical conference, and over the weekend, keeps bumping into people and having these conversations with them. And the
Okay.
conversations are about food and food science. And so every chapter is about a different food or product. So the first chapter is about vitamin C. The second chapter is about red meat. And then the third chapter is about salt. So it's about these different foods. And the question is it good or bad for you? But sort of on a deeper level, the question is always, why is there so much misinformation about all these foods? Because you've probably heard that vitamin C will help you cure the common cold, right? And there's a lot of products that sell that. It won't, though. It won't. And so understanding why people are able to claim that is a very interesting scientific and statistical concept. And that concept is called multiple hypothesis testing. It basically means that you can take a body of evidence that is negative, but if you chop it up into smaller pieces, you can get a positive signal. And so with respect to vitamin C, it's been overall shown to have no effect, right? Vitamin C, if you take vitamin C when you get sick, it does nothing. If you take vitamin C every day of your life, when you get sick, right? And you're still going to get sick the same number of times. When you get sick, it'll shorten the symptoms by maybe a few hours. So rather than being sick for 100 hours, so like 5 days-ish, you'll be sick only for 92 hours. So you'll shave 8 hours off of that illness time, which I'll let you decide if that's a,
Worth it.
significant enough benefit that you're going to take a, vitamin C tablet every day for the rest of your life. But while the evidence is overall negative, it's positive only in a very, very specific subgroup. If you don't know, because you haven't read the book, you won't know what that subgroup is. And so I'm going to tell you right now, get ready, because it's a little bit ridiculous. The subgroup of people in whom vitamin C has shown the most benefit is, hold on, let me get this right. It's skiers, ultra marathon runners, and skiers, ultra marathon runners, and Canadian soldiers on subarctic military maneuvers.
So
Those are
very
the population.
specific.
It's very specific. And you're like, why Canadian soldiers? Like, well, because they did a study in Canadian soldiers who were up in the north doing maneuvers. They gave them vitamin C tablets and they're like, ah, benefit. And you're like, well, have they done the same thing with US Marines? They're like, yes, they have. No benefit. And they're like, oh, they've done it in skiers. What about in other athletes like swimmers? Yeah, no benefit, And they're like, oh, but skiers, these are like Olympic skiers who are like training. They're like, no, this was a study done in kids attending a ski school in the Swiss Alps. So it's like, actually, it sounds like a pretty good vacation, not so much a strenuous activity. So the marketing about around vitamin C has always been about this is about people who live in cold environments and who are constantly exercising. And I'm like, well, no, that's not actually how the research was done. But they've just taken this body of research, they've carved it up into a small segment of like very, very arbitrary people doing very, very arbitrary activities. And they're able to stitch together enough that they can plausibly create a marketing slogan. There's no scientific evidence for it. And of course, if vitamin C helped cure the common cold, guess what? We would be prescribing it to people because we don't want people to get sick. The common cold costs North American society some like billions of dollars every year in terms of over-the-counter cold medication, lost productivity from work, from people calling in sick. So it's terrible. We don't give vitamin C because it doesn't work. And yet you can make it seem like it works to sell a product to people that is ultimately ineffective. And so that whole chapter where the main character, the doctor, bumps into somebody named Jim, they have this conversation as they're waiting for a plane. And then sort of every chapter is about that, sort of explaining a basic scientific concept. And, there's a love story in there. So there's like a romantic arc. And I think it's a good book. What I love too is that when people have read it, when people have read the book, they're like, this was an easy read. Like people can read it in a weekend. And I'm like, that's perfect. That's exactly what I wanted to do. Because I wasn't trying to write War and Peace. If you want to read a book that's going to like make you feel emotions that you've never felt before, that's going to fill you with angst and talk about the pain and the suffering in the world and overcoming, like, this is not that book. This is a fun romantic comedy that you're going to enjoy. And that's going to teach you some things, and it's going to make you really smart at dinner parties. At dinner parties, you could be like, red wine actually isn't good for your heart. And let me tell you why. It has to do with something called reverse causation. Like, you can become very, very clever at dinner parties just by
Okay.
throwing out these buzzwords and
Yes.
explaining to people why stuff is not actually true.
So, I mean, I think it's a good submission of the book. I haven't read it yet. I mean, where can I find it? I'm guessing Amazon.
Yeah. Anywhere books are sold. So you can find it online. If you want an autographed copy, you can just come by the clinic and I'll get you an
Yes.
autographed copy.
Next
No,
week,
but you
please.
can get it. I
Yeah.
mean, for the people who are listening to us now, you can get it at Amazon, but it's available at bookstores. You can go to Indigo Chapters here in Canada. You can go to any bookstore in the US, even in Europe, it's distributed widely. So just go to your local bookstore and order it. And if they don't have it in stock, I'm sure they can order it. And I mean, failing that, I guess you get it on Amazon. I always like to tell people, like, do try to support your local bookstores because it's good to support local businesses. So, give that a shot. And then if you have to order it in, then I guess you can always order it in.
Okay. I mean, we definitely have the links in the show notes. But yeah, I'm definitely gonna pick up one, and maybe, hey, we'll do another session like this, just talking about the book, because it does sound interesting. And just talking about myths, because like I said before, I find that a little bit of what you do when it comes to debunking all of these myths is like you're a mythbuster for medical stuff. And I have a few questions, so it's like a true or false, so
Okay.
I'm sure you've done this before, and I have some that has to do with AI, because I implement AI in clinics, and we'll get to that part later. But when it comes to coffee, right? So one of the questions was, does coffee cause cancer? But I'd have to read the book to find out. But does coffee stunt your growth? True, false? No.
No. I mean, there are reasons not to give coffee to children. I mean, coffee is a stimulant. Right. So, and it doesn't take much for it to stimulate your heart. I think, I mean, many people will probably have realized that if you drink a lot of coffee, you start to get heart palpitations. Maybe your heart feels a little fluttery. Your stomach might be a little bit upset. So, there is a toxicity to caffeine. I mean, when you're an adult, you have to drink a lot of it before you get there. But a kid, a small child who is smaller than an adult, it's not going to take much for them to start feeling the negative effects of caffeine. So should children drink caffeine? No, because they're smaller, they're going to be more susceptible to it. It's something they should avoid. I think most kids just won't like the taste of coffee because it's unpleasant. Where I think there is a bit of a public health danger is in energy drinks that are becoming much more common amongst young people. And those are problematic because they often have very high doses of caffeine and
That's
often
right.
high doses of sugar, which is not good for you either, right? So it's not good to drink, to have a lot of sugar, and it's not good to have a lot of caffeine either.
Didn't know that. So you talked about code, if there's any correlation between, how vitamin C helps you with your code, you have to have been taking it for over your lifetime and so on. So true or false, cold weather makes you more likely to catch a cold. I know some of these are really silly, but I thought that, it's just fun to go through some of these myths out there.
Cold weather does not make you catch a cold. The cold is a viral infection, right? So, when you're the reason why you get sick is because you've been infected with a virus. Being cold doesn't affect that in any way. People have tried to come up with these complex explanations for, the cold is going to suppress your immune system and all that. In reality, this doesn't make a difference. I think we've learned. This is the thing. Most people make that association because most people get sick during the winter months, but that's just because respiratory viruses spread more during the winter. And that's because we spend more time indoors. I mean, I think we learned this during COVID. The reason why influenza peaks during the winter is because kids are in school, people are indoors, we're spreading viruses amongst ourselves. So the cold, most infectious diseases are viruses that spread person to person. The ambient temperature doesn't really affect that, except in a very, very indirect way where cold, dry weather makes it a little bit easier for viruses to spread, but it's more the behavior of human beings that actually affects things. And it's how we behave and how our society is constructed that makes it easier for viruses that spread during the winter. It doesn't have anything to do with whether you are hot or cold.
Right, because that's right. Because I'm, born and raised in Cameroon, and so it's tropical, it's warm, and we have the rainy and dry season, right? And so this a statement like that doesn't necessarily apply here. It just doesn't work. And this one is, again, these are really silly, but this is one that I believe as a kid, where if you swallow gum, it stays in your stomach for 7 years. I don't.
So, I mean,
True.
so here's the thing. Everything that you swallow, it will eventually come out of you. Now, gum is an interesting thing because a lot of it is not absorbable. So, a lot of the products in gum are not something you absorb. But there's a lot of stuff that we eat that we don't metabolize and absorb. Fiber, the reason why fiber helps you maintain a regular bowel movement, the reason why it's a laxative is because it's not digested. So, fiber stays in your intestine. It's not broken down because it's a solid object there. It sucks water into your intestine, which is what makes your stool softer and easier for you to go to the bathroom. And so any non-absorbable substance will eventually make it out of your intestine. Now, it's not going to take 7 years. It takes a while for it to do the transit, but this is also one of these things that nobody's ever actually researched it, at least in a systematic way, because nobody cares.
Right.
Sometimes we don't have answers to these questions because they are so irrelevant, it's not worth the money. You have
Exactly.
to remember that research costs money. And if you have a finite amount of research funds, a finite amount of research resources, you're not going to waste it on stuff that is of
Selective.
not significant substance.
Yes, no, I definitely agree. I mean, I think it's like I said before, it's just really stupid myths that you hear about or you just grew up knowing and you're like, wait a minute, is that really true? You don't spend more than 5 minutes trying to figure out if it's true or not, but you have the random thought and you move on. And when it comes to exercising, because I do try to run every now and then. I actually did my first half marathon, and my girlfriend says I won't shut up about it, so maybe that's true, but is running bad for your knees?
So I run as well. I've done a couple of half marathons. I've done
Oh,
two
nice.
marathons. I haven't done a long race in a while because having done it, I guess I got it out of my system. I still do try to run. I've been bad the past few weeks for a variety of reasons, partly the weather, partly just busy, but I do try to run regularly. You can get injured while running. Once when training for a marathon, I got plantar fasciitis, which was really painful. Running injuries do exist. The thing that you have to do is to avoid injuries is have good running shoes, understand that there are limitations to how much you can run so you don't overdo it. You have to train properly. Is running bad for your knees? It sort of depends. If you do it properly, then no. Because yes, there's going to be sort of the regular impact of you running and hitting a hard surface. With proper shoes, you're probably going to minimize that. And then the counterweight to that is that staying in shape, not having obesity, is protective for arthritis. A lot of what drives osteoarthritis of the knees is if you gain weight, you're putting more and more weight chronically on your knees. So, there's a positive and there's a negative to exercise. As a general rule, exercise is good for you. But if you are concerned about your knees, there's many other aerobic exercises you could do as well, bicycling, swimming, where you're not putting pressure on the knees. It sort of depends. I mean, that is something that you hear a lot. I'm not sure it's universally true because there are a lot of runners out there that don't have musculoskeletal problems, but you have to be careful because it doesn't take much to get injured.
Right. So do you when you train for this marathons, do you do a lot of like leg workouts?
No, not that much. I had a regular running pattern.
Okay.
You can do a little bit of leg workouts just to sort of build up muscle mass and make sure that your joints are stable, but it's not that necessary. I mean, the biggest thing, the thing that really is, for anybody who's trying to run a marathon, the thing that gets people into trouble is they don't train properly for long enough, or they have just bad equipment, i.e. shoes. Because the reason why I love running so much is because you don't really need anything apart from running shoes. Now, it's a little bit silly how expensive running shoes are relative to like other countries where they're like, significantly cheaper. They are overpriced in North America, but you do need to get good running shoes and you do need to swap them out regularly, like every 6 months, which feels odd because the running shoes look new after 6 months, but they're no longer good. They're no longer absorbing the impact because they have worn away from the overuse. So, as long as you do that, there's not that much else you need to do. Certainly, if you're going to be a regular marathoner who wants to compete and perform well, then you're getting into a much higher echelon. But if you're sort of a casual runner who just wants to run, then just get a good pair of running shoes and run. And if something hurts, stop and rest up and don't exacerbate an injury. And if you want to train for a marathon, just get a basic training plan. As long as you're not planning to win, you don't have to take it to extremes. If you just want to run a marathon to say that you did it, which is why most of us run marathons, you just have to, start slow, build it up slowly, and get to the point where you could run for 3, 3.5 hours. If you're trying to do a marathon in, 2.5 hours, then you have to train much more aggressively. But if you're content finishing a marathon in 3, 3.5 hours, 4 hours, you don't have to run fast. You just have to not stop. And that's, I mean, partly physical, but it's also partly psychological. It's getting yourself to the point where you don't want to quit. Because let me tell you, at about the 2 hour mark of a
Yes.
marathon, you really want to quit because you're like, this is terrible.
Yeah, I was just about to say because when I did the half, I've never done a full marathon. Some of my friends, they did their first marathon last year, and they're doing another this year. Maybe I'll sign up for one. I haven't decided yet, but I think I got to the 17th kilometer, and then all this, almost like my intrusive thoughts went because I'm like, well, why did I sign up for something like this? This was such a bad idea. And so the last few kilometers was just me just hyping myself up, and at some point, the people on the side of the road cheering you on, I was finding ways to block that noise because I'm like, just let me deal with this internally and finish. So I don't know what it's like for you. You've done a few, so maybe it's easier to do these runs, but how do you find it? Is it more of a physical challenge or a mental challenge for you? Like, what is it about running that you find that, what does it do for you?
It's definitely a mental challenge because, I mean, to understand how hard a marathon is, think about what it was to run a half and then ask yourself if you could have turned around and run the whole thing again.
No, I can tell you that right now, but keep going.
It's tough. It's tough. I will say I was running a marathon once where the marathon and the half marathon were the same route, and then the half marathoners like veered off to go to the finish line, and you had to keep going. And that's when I realized, and then the energy drops because everybody's at the finish line cheering, and then you run past them and it's just quiet because there's nobody lining the streets, right? At that point, and you're just like, wow, I have another like 2 hours to go sitting there, and you're like, you're alone with your own thoughts. So there is a, I mean, there's obviously a physical limitation to it. It's very tiring. It's, your legs really do feel like jelly by the end. But it's a lot of it is mental. A lot of it is struggling to sort of find a reason to keep going, because if you stop, I mean, you can obviously start again, but there's once you stop, it's hard to get started again because just the inertia takes over. And so there is this very much sense of never stop, just always keep moving forward, and then you'll eventually get to the finish line.
No, I boy, do I know that, but that's why I said I'm not sure if I'm gonna do the full. But so I have another, this is more in the, because you talked about gaining weight and running and what that does for you. And so eating late at night, and this is a very oversimplified statement, right? Because I'm sure there's more nuances to it, but eating late at night, weight gain, like, is that really a thing, or should we be asking a more, I don't know, specific diet or what you're eating at night and so on? Like, is this really a thing?
So now we're getting into an issue of something called time restrictive eating or intermittent fasting, as it's often known. It probably doesn't matter to any great degree when you eat. It matters what you eat and how much of it you eat. There's maybe something to be said for not eating very late at night. It might make sort of indigestion, acid reflux worse. But if the issue is with regard to weight gain, when they've done studies of intermittent fasting or time-restricted eating relative to just caloric restriction, it doesn't tend to make that much of a difference in terms of weight loss. And especially in the long term, all of these diet strategies tend to equalize out because they're impossible to stick with. So the fact that people drop out of diets is what makes it, largely unsuccessful for most people. So does it make a difference? No. There are some people that fervently believe in intermittent fasting to the point that it's almost a religious doctrine for some people. But when you look at the actual scientific evidence, very, very uncertain that it makes a huge difference. Probably doesn't change all that much in the grand scheme of things.
Okay. All right. So let's dive a bit into AI, because I'm sure if you spend a little bit of time on LinkedIn, it's that's what everyone talks about, right? And rightly so. I do too, right? But there's something to be said about this AI revolution and what entrepreneurs are bringing to the market in terms of solving problems in the healthcare space. So another true force is, AI can analyze your smartwatch data and tell if you're getting sick. And I specifically choose this because I use a one of these smartwatches, Whoop, that gives me some data. So before I get into that, I'll let you answer that.
Okay, so you're right, eh? Everybody's talking about AI. I'm firmly convinced that half of them don't know what they're talking about. And I'm firmly convinced that half of them are just using algorithms, not actually using AI. They're just using templates and algorithms. But anyways, that's just my cynicism. Can an AI analyze the data on your smartwatch? Yeah, of course it can. You just have to like make it and it will. The question becomes, what's the quality of the data? Most analytics from smartwatches and wearable devices are not useful medically. I will tell you that for free. So you can get the greatest AI in the world. If the raw data is useless, what is it going to do with that information? When it comes to cardiovascular health, your Apple Watch is actually very good for one thing, diagnosing atrial fibrillation. It's a specific arrhythmia because basically your Apple Watch now can basically function like a mini ECG, mini cardiogram. So you can actually do an ECG tracing by putting your finger on the watch, and that creates the electrical circuit that allows it to create like a rhythm strip. And I have a separate device. I don't have an Apple Watch, but I have a separate device that uses the same technology, which I use for screening patients for atrial fibrillation. So it's very good for that, but that's not AI, right? That's a piece of technology and a software program built into the watch that is looking for pattern recognition and giving you a diagnosis, either atrial fibrillation or not. I'm sure somebody's eventually going to get an AI to sort of make it a better predictor, but that's in the future. So an Apple Watch is good for detecting AFib. It's very good for telling you what time it is, for giving you email and text notifications. So it's a fine device if you want to get one. But are these health analytic things that are in it, are they going to be very useful? I'm not certain they are, because right now they are not useful. Like if you brought me your Apple Watch and said, look, here's all your data, my problem is not that I don't have a way to analyze it. I mean, I could if I really wanted to sit down and make charts and look at it. It's kind of useless. Like if it tells you, oh, you're not sleeping enough, I don't trust the information. I don't think your Apple Watch is a good metric of your sleep quality. If I really want to know if you have a sleep issue, I would send you for polysomnography. If I really like a lot of the stuff they measure is almost entertainment. It's almost like, if you went and got genetic testing from 23andMe, they would tell you your ancestry and they would tell you is like, do you have the gene for curly hair? And like, who cares? That is relevant, And they say it's for entertainment. It's not for medical diagnosis. You're like, okay, well, listen, if you're entertained by it, then that's fine. But the only value I see in a watch like that is as GPS, like how far you ran, because when I was training for a marathon, I would need that to train my distances. And then at a certain point, you know what I did? I kind of remembered landmarks, so I knew when I hit 20 kilometers and then I would turn around. Is it useful? Yeah. Would I don't own one because I'm not going to buy one because they're kind of expensive and I don't find them that useful now.
Okay, I mean, you just talking about that because you could use it for training, because some of them would tell you, Hey, you need to take some rest. This is how much sleep deprivation or your sleep efficiency and so on and so forth, right? Like you said, some of this information, if someone brought this to you, you don't care. It's nice to have, but what is it going to do for you? But just as an individual training for, an activity, run.
Yeah. So, but here's the thing. If you were going to use it as like a training partner, which I used to have that, I used to have that app on my phone. That's not AI, right? That's just an app. That's just the thing. And so that's the thing. Like a lot of times you start talking about technology and you're like, oh, it's good. Yeah. Okay. It's fine. It's great. It's fine. But it's not AI. And, you know, we can use it. If you have something that's useful to you, then use it. And I think we have to make the distinction between something that is fun, useful to you as an individual, versus something that is medically validated that gives me useful in the healthcare field. And those are very, very different things. And the reality is a lot of these health apps that are out there are just useless, not validated, and frankly are stealing your personal information and sending it to like third parties that are selling it off to like others, you know? So it's like you got to be a little bit careful like with some of these things. A lot of these health apps are not great.
I know. I hear you. I hear you. I mean, this device that I use, it does record a lot of, your strain activity. It records, the sleep. Most of the smartwatches do, right? So it's not really. It's called Whoop. But it's not really a smartwatch. I was excited to get it because I was trying to just, understand my efficiency, sleep efficiency. And one night I think I had high fever, so I woke up at night like breathing heavy and so on and so forth. The next day I looked at the watch just to look at the stats, like what did it say? So it told me basically exactly what I already know, that my temperature was high and my heart rate increased. And I was like, okay, that's cool, it's interesting. Now they added a feature, so some sort of a chatbot embedded in it where it can take all of your data. If you journal, because you can journal, how much coffee intake, what your activities are, exercising, so if you're doing leg day, push, pull, whatever it is, you can record it and the number of activities, and it would calculate the muscular load, everything, and give you a summarize of your week or your day to tell you, this is how much sleep you got, this is how much strain, you put on the body. And this is your exercise. And in terms of the habits that you want to control, this is what you have. And this is how you can improve to get to your goal. And maybe dietary wise, this is what you should be looking at eating. They put the disclaimers there. They're not, medical professionals giving you that advice. But, sometimes someone would take the dietary advice I give you. It's like, make a smoothie in the morning with kale and banana and protein powder, something that anyone could have told you that, But when they have it all summarized, it's interesting because it's like it kind of knows you. I know it's scary because it does get a lot of your personal information, but what do you think about something like that?
Here's the thing. I don't think it's worth the money. It sort of depends what is your objective, right? And I always take everything from the healthcare thing. Is this going to treat a disease? Is this going to make people healthier? And the answer is no. Because if you were to get a personal trainer, which would essentially do the same thing, just, you know, from a meat sack rather than an Apple Watch, a lot of that's not going to matter. Because the main reason people exercise, the reason why you ran a marathon and the reason why I ran a marathon is not to win the marathon, right? I never was thinking to myself, oh, I'm going to win this marathon. I ran the marathon because it was fun, because it was something I wanted to do. And you don't need any of that. You don't need to eat a personal smoothie. You don't need to do the specific things. You just need to, for 6 to 12 months before the run day, you need to train. And, you know, if it was giving you a training program, but frankly, you could just find these on the internet, or you can, you know, buy a book on marathon. Like you can do stuff like this. A lot of these watches, a lot of these programs, a lot of these apps, a lot of these things, they give you a lot of information because they know that's what people want, right? They're giving you content, but it's not useful. It doesn't actually fix a problem. And so if you want to pay money for this stuff because you like having it, like there's a lot of stuff I have in my life that doesn't fix problems. Like you go to the store, you see something cute, you're like, oh, great, you have a dog, you buy him little booties. Does your dog need little booties? No, it's a dog. A dog can walk outside without boots, you know? Or it's Christmas time, so you buy, you know, a sweater that has like a Santa on top of it, so it looks like he's a reindeer and Santa's like riding him as if his sled, right? That's completely useless. but it was on sale for $10. And I'm like, okay, I'm
So,
gonna
hey,
get it. So if you enjoy that, if you want that feedback because you like interacting with your device, then you can do it. I always approach these things, and that's what sort of the podcast is about, is like, is this actually useful medically? And the answer is no. And I think that's where the danger is, because a lot of these products, they try to imply that they're medicine. They try to sort of creep into the space. Whereas if we force them to go through the same regulatory process that we expect of medications and actual devices that we use in medicine, they would fail because they're terrible. Like, how good is your smartwatch at measuring your sleep pattern comparative to polysomnography that we would do in a sleep lab? It's terrible.
okay.
It's not
So,
great.
okay. Sorry, I'm interrupting you there. But what about in the use case for athletes? You know, like people who train at a certain level, you're not going to get them doing these sleep tests like 24/7 as opposed to having a watch or whatever.
But they might, though, actually, like the ones who are training for the Olympics are probably using this high level stuff. Now, I don't know specifically what to do for the Canadian Olympic team, but a lot of them probably are. Like, a lot of them are doing like blood gases and analyzing like their carbon. Like, they, here's the thing, training the days where, you know, you could be an amateur athlete and compete in the Olympics are over. If you want to compete in the Olympics, you basically have to start as a child and you get put into a funnel that drives you there. The other thing too is that I'm not convinced any of this makes a difference. A lot of sports athletes will use it. A lot of sports programs will do it. A lot of supplements, a lot of stuff is used in sports because they're saying it's like, well, if I can shave a fraction of a second off of my time, that could make the difference between winning gold and not winning gold, and that's what I'm in for. I don't know that it, but that's the thing. A lot of these things have never been studied, right? If you wanted to prove it, what you would do is you would take a group of Olympic athletes, give them device X versus device Y or nothing, and see if they can improve their performance in a measurable way. Like, is this going to help you win a race? If you really wanted to be good about it, you would take Olympic teams, split them in two, and say, is Group A going to win more gold medals than Group B? And no one's done that because it's in no one's interest to do that. I would be surprised if you could ever design a clinical trial where something is going to result in more gold medals. What invariably happens is that the companies that have all these gadgets and tools and resources are the wealthier countries that support their Olympic athletes. Why do the big countries win all the gold medals at the Olympics? Because they have the money, right? So is it the devices or is it the fact that they have wealthy Olympic programs that can support athletes and support them financially during their entire training, whereas smaller countries don't? You know, it's tough to be an Olympic athlete when you have to go and work at a restaurant part-time to pay your rent.
No, I hear you. I mean, that being said, I think, you know, after using this watch for since January, I would say. And the main reason why I bought it was just to understand my sleep patterns. Like, did I learn something? Sure. You know, and I could have easily have learned this, maybe having multiple conversations with, you know, a health professional like yourself. So when it comes to another thing, another reason why I bought it was about balance, you know, so because I started my, you know, entrepreneur journey. It's, you know, it's been a couple of years and, you know, building a startup and you're wearing different hats and all this fun stuff that you get to do. And you hear a lot of people talk about, you know, balance and so on and so forth. And first of all, I don't think that when it comes to certain goals that you're trying to achieve, you should really be looking at balance too much, you know, because it's like, what's going to be the trade-off, you know, like, what are you going to sacrifice to get achieve this goal? But when I was looking at getting the watch, I'm like, all right, so let me try to monitor my sleep to know that to make sure I get X amount of sleep every day so that I can be fully functional. Weeks will go by and I'm getting maybe, I don't know, 4, 5, or 6 hours of sleep a day. And the watch would tell me, hey, you didn't get enough sleep. And I'm like, so what? You know, I have things to do. I have clients to take care of. I have marketing or whatever to do. So it's not giving me any value. And I said to myself the other day, I think maybe this is something that I get way down the line that, you know, everything's maybe like my company's running more so slightly on autopilot and I can focus on other things that I don't know. But I don't see the value for me right now. Sure, I got a 1 year subscription, so you know, that's another conversation. But just to add to your point, I learned a thing or two, but it's just one of those things, just to say, I used it. I learned from experience. I used it and it taught me a few things, but would I renew the subscription? I don't think so.
And I think that's what a lot of people realize. You end up realizing that it's not really worth the money because it just doesn't do anything. Like you realize it doesn't change your behavior in any way.
Yeah, that's the best way to summarize it. And so in terms of predicting heart attacks, have you come across any AI technology or tools out there that whether it's not necessarily, predict heart attacks or stroke from, looking at a CT scan or whatever it is? Like, are you familiar with any tools like that? I think I'd mentioned to you on Rapid AI before.
Well, so there's a lot of so risk prediction in cardiology is like a whole field in itself, and people have derived a number of different risk scores. So, is AI going to be useful in that? Yeah, potentially, because it's going to allow you to analyze a lot of data from a lot of people, maybe refine these algorithms. It's going to automate stuff that is a little bit tedious for you as a professional. But just the sort of joke is that you use an algorithm when you don't want to talk to the patient, right? Like a lot of times patients come in, they're like, they're elderly, they have high blood pressure, they have diabetes, they're a little bit, they have obesity, maybe they smoked in the past. You don't need an AI to tell you that person's at high risk. Like you should be risk controlling that person's risk factors, So AI, I think, is going to be very useful for database research, for, throwing it at an electronic medical record and having it flag the high-risk patients that you should call and bring back to clinic for a follow-up. So I think it's going to be, I mean, what computers are very good at, they're very good at doing the things that humans find tedious, which is complex math, right? We could do the math ourselves. It's just the computer can do it faster. So I think a lot of these AI tools, whether it's in cardiology or radiology, right, where they're, let's say you're working at a hospital and that hospital has done 1,000 chest x-rays in that day. The AI is going to be very good at looking for suspicious patterns, flagging the high-risk x-rays that you as a radiologist should read first. But whenever somebody says, like, is AI going to replace doctors? And the answer is no, for one very important reason, is a liability issue. At a certain point, somebody has to be responsible. You can't, if the AI gets something wrong, who's at fault? The company that designed it, the hospital that employed it. So, because these issues have not been sorted out, it's always, at least in the short term, going to require a human to check everything. Like, nobody's going to start a patient on medication because the AI said so. The AI may flag something, and then you as a human are going to have to look back at it and decide if this was clinically meaningful or not. So, I think that's what's going to happen. I mean, AI is going to be very good at automating the stuff that we find boring, like on radiology, like tracing out this particular thing, stuff that we now do by hand that a computer could probably do much more efficiently, automatically calculating stuff, automatically generating a report, and then you fixing it. So, AIs, I think, are going to become part of the medical system. I think what's going to happen is that they're going to get worked into pre-existing programs, electronic medical records, software packages that already exist, but they're not going to be. They are going to be evolutionary. They're probably not going to be revolutionary.
That's right. That's right. I mean, that's why I asked you about stroke prediction. Say I'm a patient, I go to the emerge, and because I was worried that I'm having a stroke, and I get a CT scan or the appropriate scan. And once the radiologist gets the scan, they have it integrated with this extra AI tool that can look at the scan, and because of its predictive analysis, can say, all right, this patient is 95% to getting a stroke in the next, I don't know, maybe it wouldn't say a time duration. I'm not a cardiologist. I don't understand what really, what, how to break that down. But looking at this app, and maybe at some point we can take a look at the app together, because I'd really be curious to know what you think about them. Because honestly, what I do outside of bringing, just helping clinics on operational efficiency is just finding interesting tools like this that can help radiologists, can help physicians like yourself, just give better treatment to better take care of your patients, right? So if you have an app that does exactly what I was explaining, which there exists, so Rapid AI, and I don't work for them, or it's not an ad for them really. I'm just really curious about a technology like theirs that has been FDA approved and so on, that can really predict a stroke on a patient. I don't know, what are your thoughts on that?
So it sort of depends on whether the question is, will it help it diagnose a stroke or will it help predict a stroke? Like in the scenario that you gave, if you think you were having a stroke and you went into the hospital and you said, I think I'm having a stroke, and the ER doctor didn't think you were sort of like, faking or whatever and said, okay, well, let's get a CT scan. They would look at the CT scan right then and there. Like, so you don't need an AI in that circumstance. You're going to see the scan. Like, maybe the AI is going to do a lot of the calculations. Maybe it'll flag suspicious areas, but the radiologist on call would just look at it. Like, I don't think we're ever going to get to the point where the AI would replace the radiologist. I'm thinking, like, maybe there's a situation where if you're in a remote community and there's no physician on site, the AI would look at it. And then if it was thing abnormal, they would flag it. And then you would call the radiologist in the nearest community. Like, maybe there's a scenario there. But in terms of diagnosis, there's a very easy way to tell if you're having a stroke. You look at the person's scan, and either there's a big black area where there's no blood flow, or there's a bleed if there's a bleed there. So it's not going to be useful for, I mean, not, I should say it's not going to be useful. It's not going to change anything in terms of diagnosis, at least in the short term. In terms of prediction, I mean, again, it's possible that what you're going to do is set the AI loose on a large database of information, have it look at stuff and identify high-risk individuals that you as a person might not identify because sometimes data becomes overwhelming, right? When you have all this information in the electronic medical record, you may not be seeing that, their blood sugar is elevated, that their cholesterol is above target because they came in with a broken bone, you're focused on that. And so you're missing all this ancillary stuff that frankly isn't relevant to the visit at the time. So could it be useful as an adjunct to identify patients that need to be seen more intensively for something? Yeah. And I think that's its real power. It's in big data, right? Looking at going through doing, these millions, billions of computations very, very quickly, but it's not going to replace the you as an individual. It's not going to replace the care for you as an individual, with the caveat as it's going to do a lot of the calculations. So let's say on a particular scan, or if with an MRI, you have to compile the images, you have to calculate stuff, and before you have to be there and you have to trace it yourself with a mouse, you can easily conceive of a way that now an AI is going to replace a lot of the work that would have previously been done by the technician. So is it going to replace doctors? No. Is it going to replace technicians? Maybe. Or it's going to be to the point that it's going to remove a lot of the tasks from them, that it's going to increase the throughput. So you're going to be able to process more scans per day because a lot of the tedium has been automated. So there is certainly like an area there where it could be helpful, but we'll have to see. I mean, it's at the end of the day, the big companies that make this equipment are going to have to implement these into their software packages. Like, there's no other way around it unless it's built into the software that you use to analyze scan images. It's not going to be useful. Like, it's going to be very hard to take a separate program and integrate it with the software that you already have to analyze images. Like, that's going to be very, very hard to integrate.
I see that there's a lot of PACS systems that the ones that the radiologists use that are exactly doing that because they already have the environment to be able to build upon, right? And the database and so on. So it just makes sense. But just going back to cardiovascular activities and the correlation to cardiovascular activities and weight loss, because this is something that I'm very, very interested in, because I tend to work out as much as I can, and a lot of people around me, you go to the gym and you listen to a lot of stuff on social media and talk to trainers, and they tell you how much you should be running or doing jumping jacks or whatever it is, using the jump rope, or maybe you should run after you do your lift weights and so on. But what would you say is really the best way to approach it when it comes to just not necessarily weight loss, but just having a healthier gym routine that would lead you to maybe the body size or whatever you're looking to achieve, but really when it comes to running or cardiovascular activities versus maybe shredding off some fats there.
Yeah. So get ready for this. Exercise is not an efficient way to lose weight. If your objective is to lose weight, you should eat less. it is very, very hard to quote unquote burn off calories, which is actually not what's actually happening because, okay, here, let me quiz you. When you lose weight, where does the weight go? Like, where does the matter? Like that was substance, that was a physical thing. Where does that go when you lose weight?
It's converted to something else if it's, I don't know.
It is converted to something else. Most people say is like, oh, you lose it as heat, as energy. That's actually not true. What you're actually doing is you're exhaling it. That's the carbon dioxide. So the carbon dioxide you're breathing out is basically the metabolic byproduct of stuff that you've burned off in your body. So when you lose weight, you're actually exhaling it. You're not burning it. But we say burn energy because that's just how we talk. But the point is this, you exercise is not an efficient way to lose weight. If you want to lose weight, you have to eat less. It is much easier to not eat a calorie than it is to burn away a calorie. And so if your objective is weight loss, it really has to be caloric restriction through diet. And that's where you get into the whole thing of like, should you just eat less? Should you do time-restricted eating? And the reality is that most of these things don't make a huge difference. The reason why medications like Ozempic, semaglutide, also known as Wegovy, the reason why these medications work and why they become so popular all of a sudden is because they curb your appetite. People lose weight because they eat less, and it's the first weight loss medication that actually works. So, what's the best form of exercise? Well, don't exercise for the purpose of losing weight. Exercise for the purpose of being healthy. For that, if your objective is to be healthier, you can do any type of exercise that brings you joy. There is no right way to exercise. There's no wrong way to exercise. If you like to run, run. If you want to play tennis, play tennis. If you want to do yoga, do yoga. None of that matters. The greatest benefit we get from exercise is when we go from zero to something. And so all of this, getting a personal trainer, doing, these apps and these fitness routines, like do this. This is the exercise for your body type. All of that is to some degree worthless, because the biggest problem we have in our society is that people are too sedentary. So you should just do something. Everything else is more for your own personal enjoyment and recreation. Do you have to spend money on that? It's up to you. It's your money. I wouldn't, because I just run, or occasionally I'll play like sports, but I'm mostly like I like to run because it fits my schedule, and I don't really care if it's this or that, or I'm not gonna ever try to win a race. I just run because it's fun and it relaxes me and it's a good form of exercise.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm sure a lot of my friends would be interested to listen to this because it's something that we talk about all the time, and like I said, you can have a trainer at the gym, friends at the gym that talk about this, people with and without exercise and experience, and you have dietitians and nutritionists telling you different things. And sometimes I think maybe I'm not asking the right questions when it comes to just being healthy and just shredding off losing weight. I'm not really necessarily looking to lose weight necessarily, but maybe I am on, but on different parts of your body, right? Like if it's you just want that 8-pack because the summer is from around the corner, sure, that's different. But it's like you said, whatever it is, it really has to do with your the way you eat, right? So that's a question everyone should be asking: what's my diet like? And I always hesitate using the word diet because I think that just sounds very short term, right? Like, what's your lifestyle around food? Like the way you eat, right?
Actually, so we tend to use the term diet to mean like Atkins, keto, paleo, like these fads. And but I mean,
Yes.
medically speaking, diet is the way in which you eat and the types of foods that you eat. And so the best diets are things like the Mediterranean diet, for example, or the DASH diet, which are more dietary strategies, which are about limiting pre-processed foods, limiting red meat, limiting all this stuff, and just eating healthy. A lot of fruits and vegetables, a lot of whole grains, very little meat. That's the appropriate diet. And I mean, that sort of gets back to the book. A lot of the stuff that you hear on the news or read online, a lot of it's just not true with regard to food. There's so much misinformation with regard to food. And the reality is, you know how to eat healthy. Avoid pre-processed foods, avoid junk food, and eat a lot of fruits and vegetables. That's the secret. That's all it is. But of course, if you're going to write a diet book, you can't write that in a diet book. It won't sell. You have to convince people that you have some sort of secret knowledge that they need to follow you to get. And I think that's why you get a lot of this misinformation with regard to food, because you have to convince people that you have the secret knowledge, when in reality, it doesn't matter. Right? A lot of it doesn't matter. We know what healthy eating is like. It's less junk food. That's the key. That's the secret.
That's interesting stuff. So, if we switch back to my favorite topic, talking about AI, do you see the use case? Because we demoed AI Scribe in your practice, right? Just helping you with note taking and so on. And this was something that, because like I told you off camera, you are one of the more efficient physicians that I've worked with or I've met, where you find very efficient ways to document your patient visits, right? As opposed to maybe some of the physicians that, maybe they still write on paper, type it out, and so on and so forth. They use dictation or they use a physical scribe, right? Like someone who sits in the room, and which I think that's ridiculous. Well, if they're a medical student, all right, different conversation. So how did you find, just trying out a product like that, AI Scribe, and do you see that at some point you would be able to fit in your practice, and what would be the ideal scenario for you?
I mean, I think it's interesting. It performed better than I thought it would, to be very honest with you. I mean, it's not perfect, so you still have to edit it. And here's the thing, because I can type very fast, like I learned how to touch type from a young age. So for me, if I'm gonna go, I have to go back and edit the note anyways, well, I might as well just type it out. And I know I have a template that I use, and when patients return, I just use the previous note and just make whatever changes have happened. So for me, it's not that much of a time saver because I'm still gonna have to go back and change stuff anyways. But for an older physician that never really became comfortable with computers, that doesn't really write stuff, I see where the value is because you're generating a more complete note with little effort. So, I mean, AI is almost going to become the equalizer. It's going to take bad physicians and make them better. I just hope it doesn't take good physicians and make them worse. Is AI going to be useful? Yeah, I think it is going to be useful. The note dictation thing doesn't really help me because I've already found a solution that works and is just as good. Where is it going to be useful in the future? I mean, essentially, like a spell check is, I mean, it's not quite an AI, but it's in that vein, right? So is it going to help me, write better notes? Is it going to help? And I have a lot of physicians who are like, who are not good writers. Now, I wrote a book. So for me to write a patient note, I see a lot of physicians, they struggle. They're like, I don't know how to write this. I'm like, what do you mean? Just write words like, dear so-and-so, do this for this patient. If you are a physician and let's say you're a physician that's not good in English or in French, right? And you're struggling with the language. Well, then an AI is going to be helpful to you, right? If you're not a very verbal person, you don't know how to write well, an AI is going to be helpful to you. It's not helpful to me personally. Where I have found AI, and I'll give you a sort of example, I was making presentations for the class that I teach. And they've built an AI into all the Microsoft stuff now, right? So in PowerPoint, when I was making my PowerPoint, now they give you these suggestions in the sidebar and it auto formats the slide. So I'm like, oh, great. It saved me 15 seconds on that slide. But when you're making a PowerPoint, at least now I click a button and it puts the colors and it formats the text. And I'm like, okay, great. Because I don't care, right? I don't care. But it's automating a task that is tedious and doesn't really require a lot of like neural power to make happen. It's something that I used to have to do for aesthetic reasons. And now it's, the AI is doing it for me. I'm like, okay, great. But I'm still generating the PowerPoint, right? So it's useful in very, very specific things. It helps me do the stuff that I don't care about. And for some physicians, the stuff they don't care about is charting, because charting can be very tedious. So if it's a very tedious thing that you have to do every day and the AI can take the lion's share of the burden off of your shoulders, then it's useful in that type of situation.
Right, because you mentioned auto text, I think that's one of the very subtle effects of using tools like this that I, always admit to my clients is that when I personally use Grammarly, for example, I stopped using it because it got really annoying at some point. But or even your iPhone, right? You start typing and it suggests you write in an email, it suggests stuff, and all you tend to do is just click on the suggestion sometimes, and you stop using your brain power, And then when you go to write in those moments where you actually have to write on paper, and you're like, huh, Like, how do you spell color again? Is it UR or is it OR? You know, and this very subtle things that we depend so much on this autocorrect. I think that we need to be very vigilant, whether you're a physician, what kind of professional you are, to using these AI tools, because I don't know, you have to stay, find a way to stay sharp and just have it complement your skills, right? And not,
Yeah, you have to be careful that it doesn't become something that you like a crutch that you depend on. Like you have to be able to work without it. It's fine if it's helping you do something faster, but if you start depending on it and you start forgetting how to spell stuff, then that's going to be an issue. And you also have to be careful about it getting into a situation where now everybody sounds the same because you're just getting all this auto-generated text and it becomes meaningless, right? Everybody's like saying things that are like, no, at a certain point, you need to personalize what you're doing for that patient. And if you forget that, well, that's going to decrease the quality of medical care.
Yeah, exactly. I use it. I use whether it's any of the LLMs out there, ChatGPT, Claude, or DeepSeek. It's my domain somehow. So I try to stay current. I use them to sometimes help me write my content. I used to use it a lot, but I use it less to write because it doesn't feel authentic, right? And sure, I can sit on a Sunday and say, let me write 30 different posts and just schedule them and put, but that's not providing the value that I want to provide to my audience on LinkedIn. So I rather, wake up in the morning, I go through my routine and just sit down and think of what I want to write about, and I can do some research using these tools and then craft it myself, so that you don't lose that authenticity to your writing style, right? Because if you look at a lot of posts, sometimes they're just, you can notice the pattern. You can see, okay, this was used by almost this AI tool or that AI tool. It's gotten crazy how, but hey, it helps. It's like you said, it helps some people to that are not good at certain things or writing or language. So they use this to complement that. But for me, I think when it comes to writing, that's one thing that I noticed. Okay, I need to reposition myself how I use this tool to just create content and provide value on social media. So in terms of your book, are you looking to write another one? Is that something you're
It's in the plan. It's in the plan. I have to carve out some time to do it. But yes, people have asked me, will there be a sequel? I think there will be a sequel because people want to know what happens to the characters. Like I left the ending a little bit open-ended. So, there might be a sequel coming.
Interesting. Okay, there's no timeline, so we won't.
I don't have a plan yet. I just because I'm getting married this summer, so that's like been occupying a lot of my time. But after that, I think I'm gonna sit down and see if I can get like a plan in place for writing the sequel.
Okay. So one very question that I always ask, all of my guests, which is something that I talk about, on and off camera, is just the mindset that you got to have when it comes to problem solving, right? In any field that you have, you can listen to all these mindset gurus and on social media, and sometimes they say things that really do help and inspire and motivates you, but you can't really base on your drive on motivation because you're not motivated every day. So for you, you wear so many different hats, you do so many different things, and mostly things that you love doing, right? So it might be slightly easier for you to go about doing something like that. So if someone were asking you, hey, what do you have a system when it comes to achieving a goal or completing a task at hand, whether it is building a piece of software or just mentoring students and at the same time running your clinic and appearing on TV, managing your time in that sense and just having that drive to keep doing what you do, being in the right mindset. Is there habits or activities that you need to, that you do that you find that works for you?
No, I mean, I wish I had a secret sauce. I don't. I just, try hard and, surround yourself by good people. And, I have a very good secretary, Rina, at the clinic who just keeps things running smoothly. And, I pay her a very good salary because I want her to stay. And when you're building a business, if you treat people right, they will stay with you. And what gets a lot of people is they try to save, a dollar here and a dollar there, and they don't realize it's costing them more in the long term. They are, the old expression, they are penny wise and pound foolish. So surround yourself with good people who are going to do good work. Know your limitations and just try. And you just keep trying. And if you love what you do, it won't seem bad. Like, I do podcasts and write because I enjoy it. And yeah, it's hard sometimes. You want to take days off. You have to know when to take breaks, but you just try. And if you are a genuine, nice person, people will be nice with you and people will recognize that and people will treat you well in response. And I think that's the secret, which is either very profound or very simplistic, depending on how you want to look at it.
Amazing, amazing. Well, thanks a lot for your time today. I hope that we can do this again at some point in the future, especially after I must have, read your book. And yeah, so thanks for joining me. And you said you're getting married in 2 months, you said?
Yeah, it'd be in June.
Okay, awesome. Congrats, and yeah, let's do this again sometime.
All right, sounds good.
Awesome.
Take care.
All right, you too.